of Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. Judge Christopher Cooper said Congress named it to honor the late president, and it cannot be officially named for anyone else except by an act of Congress. The order issued yesterday also temporarily halts the plan to shut it down for 2 years for renovation. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
Well, friends, it is that time once again. You've joined the conversation on WVIK, a weekly celebration of local radio the way it's meant to be brewed. This week, my guest is Dana Starkel, who's back on the show to tell some more stories and share some more insights of our particular corner of the world. I'm Kai Swanson. Hope you'll stick around for this week's conversation. Well, Dana, I have to tell you, it's often the case that when I get a chance to meet someone interesting on this program, which is just about every week, at the end of the hour, I think, man, I can't wait to have that person back, but I'm bringing the dream to reality by getting you back. Thanks for taking some time to spend with us.
You bet. Great to be here.
And I don't want to spend too much time on it because people should go back and listen, find out all about them for themselves and read books about it. But just to recap our last conversation, and I need you to fill out the details, but you had a wonderful and interesting growing up. You had an adventuresome father. You did some amazing things with your father and brother and all sorts of things. And this kind of that journey culminated in a trip by canoe from Canada all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico and around. And but that's only one part. Another is you had an amazing journey in music and in music education. Mm-hmm. And that journey continues. And I'm just feel so lucky that your path eventually led you here to this bend in the river. And we can get to all that other stuff. But how did I do? Did I recap most of what we talked about last time?
I think so.
But do tell us a little more, just for those who didn't hear, about how this journey with your father and your brother came about.
Right. So, you know, when I was a young kid, like a lot of kids, I had big imagination and I loved animals. And through kind of a quirky situation, I ended up getting this book, Tarzan. It was my first allowance. I was, you know, and I just was fascinated by that book. You know, it had a, you know, it was not real, but in the back it had a, you know, how you could speak to the apes. And I'm like, this has got to be really authentic, you know. Anyway, so that became my big thing was, after reading that book, I had this dream of this idea that I wanted to walk to the jungle. And I think the reason I wanted to walk there was because my dad used to take us out for really, really long walks. Like sometimes we would be walking for 4, 5, 6 hours when we were young kids through the forest and sand dunes and different things because there were sand pits a lot around Winnipeg where I grew up. So I think there was some kind of a magical thing about walking, like, you know, this idea that you could just walk and things would change as you went. And I mentioned that to my dad, who at the time had just gone through a divorce, and he, you know, all of the kids were all shuffled away, and then my dad was off on this canoe trip. He was Brigade 70, this centennial trip, where it was pretty cool. Yeah, Prince Charles came and met him at the end of that and congratulated him on this centennial visit, you know. But right while that was going on, I was shuffled away with my mom and in a new family, which I didn't want to be a part of. And so as soon as my dad was back, I got on my bicycle and I biked home and I said, I'm home. And my mom never put up any resistance because she knew I was pretty pigheaded about anything. And my dad says, when I got home, when I came back, then his life changed because now he had something to look forward to. And then he started thinking, like when I mentioned this idea about walking to the jungle, he thought, you know, he was always looking for something that was impossible, that would stretch him beyond what he thought was possible. Because so many times he would set himself goals, he would achieve them. And then he felt a little bit hollow because he felt like, you know, I could have done more. How much could I more have done, you know? And so this idea of the Amazon trip was a mixture of his love of history and geography, you know, the old explorers, you know, what they had done, you know, Cortez, Orellana, Columbus, all of these different people that had traveled these rivers and coastlines. He thought, why couldn't, you know, modern day man stitch all of that together? With our ingenuity, our technology, our maps and everything, they were all superstitious, everything else, you know, and they managed to travel these great distances. And he thought, you know, so he came up to me when I was a young kid and he said, you know, Dana, how would you like to paddle to the jungle? And, you know, me freezing to death in Winnipeg all my life. That's all I needed. I didn't need anything more than that. But then when he showed me the globe, and I could kind of visualize where this was and the fact that we could travel this distance. And we were always doing a lot of canoeing. So I never for one second ever thought, you know, this was too much or that I couldn't do it. You know, I was kind of like a typical kid, you know, dad's Superman, whatever he says you can do, you can do. And I kind of... That was pretty much right up till I was 19 years old. Now, once we got into the trip a little bit... We started dealing with military and different things. Well, then you see that your dad's as scared as anyone else.
Mm-hmm. Human.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an amazing way to frame that up. And yeah, I do hope folks would go back and listen to the earlier interview to hear all those great details. But I do want to finish the journey, but then I want to go back and fill in some of the things that we didn't have time for before. But if I recall correctly, you got to the northern coast of the continent of South America, and there were some adventures skirting the coast of Colombia, but I think we had to stop somewhere around Venezuela. Do you have any stories you want to bring us around the horn?
Sure. Well, I mean, just as a trail off, because I'm not sure how much we did of Colombia, but, you know, just as a sum up of Colombia, you know, the first half of Colombia is the area like Santa Marta, different places where it's more of a tourist place where, you know, not so many North Americans maybe go to Santa Marta, but a lot of people around the world do. And Santa Marta is also a huge drug port, you know. And so the thing I always remember about coming into Santa Marta is that, you know, we always like coming into big centers. Well, there's all the hotels, we can get water, we can get some you know, new food and different things, you know. And I always remember we're coming along the coast and we come in and we finally see all the high rises in the city and finally we're here in Santa Marta. Our maps weren't so great all the time. We were a lot of times using like highway maps.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And the mountains were just like squiggly lines. I used to think they were really, I think somebody was just squiggly lines. They didn't even make any sense. And I remember we see, okay, we're finally in Santa Marta. We come in there, we pull up our canoe, we're on shore. And we're like, okay, we're going to find a place, you know, where we can camp in the sand there at night and stuff. We start talking to some guy and we're like, yeah, we're so happy to be in Santa Marta. He goes, this is not Santa Marta. We're like, what do you mean? Oh, no, Santa Marta is way further down the coast. He says, I forget the name of of this city, but it's right before Santa Marta. He says, you hardly will even see this on the map. This is just a town where all the drugs come running out of. We're like, oh, yeah. And this guy was a dealer, too. He was up to stuff that night. And it's all, you know, the military oversees it down there. Mm-hmm. So I remember when we got before we left Santa Marta, there's a big military base there, a naval base. And by that time we had smartened up. We knew that, you know, trying to avoid these places was you know, forget it. They're always going to see you or track you down. So we flipped it, kind of like George Costanza. We said, well, we'll just go straight in there and we'll demand to see the captain and see what happens. And it worked great. You know, all of a sudden people thought we had some authority, you know. So we came in there and we told them, we said, we need to get some documents because we're going down coming up to the Guajira Peninsula, where all the real mafia-controlled towns are and everything. And we're going to need something to protect us, something to help us, you know. So he gave us this really official document, but it's all in Spanish. My Spanish was almost really, really bad, and my dad's was worse. And so now we've got this document, but we don't really know what it means. But as we're going down the coast, every once in a while, people would come after us, you know, like they would. Sometimes it was military in little towns, and sometimes it was fishermen who thought we were up to something. And we would always present this document. And whenever we would present this document, everything was just would go really good for us, you know. But what we found out later on was that it basically, when people saw this document, they figured we were in cahoots with the military, with the drug trade, and that's why they had to leave us alone.
Oh, man.
We were in this one place. It was actually in Venezuela after we got out of Colombia, Isla de Oro. And it's this really, really ritzy club.
Yeah.
Ritzy club. And they told us it was like a fortune in American money to have a membership there. And we came in there and they welcomed us in. Next thing you know, they put us up in a room and they're feeding us and everything. And my dad said, Dana, what do you notice about these guys, the way that they're looking at us? And I said, well, you know, it reminds me of how the Colombianos, like the bad guys, would kind of just like stare right through you like you almost didn't exist and they're just figuring out what they're going to do, right? Mm. And he says, yeah. So we started talking to these guys, and they weren't from, they're all from Colombia. And this Isla de Oro was another place, another front where they were running drugs out of. You know, but my dad says, Dana, we got to get out of here.
Jeez Louise. And you did.
Yeah, we did. We got up early that morning and took off. You know, most of the time people, they don't really care that much. Like, as long as you're not involved, like we were still in Colombia, we were sleeping on a beach and there's little fishing huts around us, but it was a bay that was really isolated. And, we were sleeping on the beach, and at night, these guys that we had, there was like families there. They came up and they said, "You can't lie on this beach. You're going to get killed. You know, they're going to see you. They'll shoot you." You know, and we said, "Well, we're too tired. We're just going to stay here. We're low down. You know, we're just lying on the beach."
Yeah.
But sure enough, you know, shrimp boat comes, you know, wandering into the bay. And all night long, they're loading bales of marijuana and stuff in there. The next day, we went wandering through the jungle because we were stuck there. We couldn't get out of this place. And my dad found a shack, and it was all loaded up with thousands of pounds of marijuana seeds.
Yeah.
And it was all just there for growing and shipping and whatever, you know.
Wow.
But we never, you know.
Yeah.
People didn't, we weren't pestering anything, you know. And as long as we didn't bother anybody, you know, we weren't doing anything. They didn't care.
Yeah, and there are so many types of governments, and they shift so much. In so this was about what year was this?
So that was 1981.
Okay. Yeah. And then you know you could come back 20 years later, find a different regime, and 20 years later find a different one. In Venezuela, we just at Augustana's graduation a week or so ago graduated an outstanding young man from Venezuela.
Right,
and. You know, and I think we're going to get into this a little bit more, but I mean, if you don't go and meet people, it's what Twain said, that travel is fatal to prejudice. You know, you can be sold a story that doesn't exist. Well, anyway, we got to finish this story. What, some of those other nations and former colonies that you had to make your way around the shoulder, the Guyanas, Suriname.
We didn't go through those.
You stayed away. Okay.
No, because, and I'll explain that, but I just wanted to say one last story about Colombia, because it's so pertinent to what's going on right now. When we were in this bay, we called it Bahia de Confuso. That wasn't the real name of it, but Bay of Confusion, because the trade winds just blew over this place. Big, massive breakers coming into this mountainous coast, and we're trapped in this bay, and we couldn't get out of this thing, you know? But in that bay where they were smuggling all the drugs out of and stuff, different nights they had these big white fiberglass speedboats. The exact ones that are being blown up right now.
Really?
You know, and what I couldn't comprehend, and neither could my dad, is that these guys, and like a lot of them were being forced into doing this. They would get, their families would be threatened. And because what they're being told to do, it was something they would never do you know, these are fishermen. They know how dangerous the ocean is. They're saying, you get in a speedboat and you're going to go straight across to Miami, across the, you know, the Caribbean. I mean, one storm comes up, you're dead.
Yeah.
There's no way you're going to handle that.
Right.
But I just remember thinking, like, I can't believe that these guys are doing this. They had these really powerful motors so they could go fast. And I'm sure they would pick their weather. But still, just weather can be very unpredictable out there, you know. I just remember, like, we were afraid to even leave the shore there. And here these guys are going to go straight across in a speedboat.
Just a technical question, because I am a complete duffer when it comes to paddle sports. But when you're trying to get out through those breakers, how did you do that?
So it depended so much on the situation, because, you know, I guess the first thing that's really... The first thing that's really interesting to think about is that when it comes to the ocean and the coastline, it changes every mile.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can do a stretch one day where we've got no breakers. We've got, you know, like maybe there's shallows out at sea or the wind is offshore or whatever.
Tides affect it?
Sometimes you have currents, but more along the deep water. It's really deep, like mountainous coastline, you'll get tidal currents along the shore, but not so much, you know, unless there's a big river mouth somewhere and the current's flowing down a certain direction. Sometimes we were against currents. We didn't really notice it so much, but sometimes we'd get at the end of the day, we didn't really go very far, and we're like, I guess we were pushing against something. But you can't really...
Right.
When we're out in the ocean, we're so focused on the swells coming in. But as far as launching in the surf, we had to do that a lot. And at first, we were terrible. We didn't have a clue. But what we would do is we had our canoe all fully loaded and we had our cover on. It was like basically sealed like a kayak. And so we would get into we would try to pick beaches. Now, this is the thing. When people say, well, how do you get out into the surf? It's where you land. Because if you land in a really bad place, it's almost impossible to get back out, because if what you're looking for is some gradual breakdown, you know, like it can't just be like one big master monster wave that's going to crest and break, you know, 20 feet out from shore. You can't get past the thing. You know, you can get through it. It knocks you down or knocks you back to shore. And then so what we would look for a relatively gradual breaking down of the wave. So then we would get out. And then the first couple layers of it, it would be going over our head. We would wait till it breaks and it go over. But then we could get into the deeper water. And once we got into deeper water, then all we had to do was beat the top one of that.
Yeah.
But a lot of it was timing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and timing is a lot to do with another aspect of the story, I would posit here, and that is that this was a great time in your life relative to the time it was in your father's life. And I get more and more sensitive to that as years go by. I mean, I've got grandkids now, and my kids are in their adulthood. And, you know, there are some things that we are past the time for. But you guys chose the sweet spot to be able to do this together.
Well, give my dad all the credit in the world on that one. I think it was just a mixture of all the things that he went through as a kid. You know, he was very practical. You know, and like even getting out of work when he was 47, like, you know, not how many people back in those days was doing that. You know, he's like, I'm going to work till I'm 47. I'm going to plan this canoe trip. And when I finish the trip, I'm going to do more adventures. And I'm just going to spend my life doing things that I love to do. And he knew that, you know, once we got out of school, that was the time. Because after we're out of school,
Life
gets busy and it's going to become almost impossible. It was difficult as it was, but, you know, I had that window and...
Well, now I do want you to take us home to the Amazon before we get any other asides going here. But you know, Dana, because you've been on the show, the asides are the whole conversation, right? Well, tell us about how the trip ended.
Right. Well, you know, the crazy thing is when everybody knows the Amazon. You always hear about the Amazon. But honestly, the Amazon was probably one of the least interesting parts of our trip. So, you know, as a finale for our 12,000 miles that we paddled, it was not nearly what you might think. You know, like when I left Winnipeg, even at, you know, as 19 years old, my idea of the Amazon was literally like a river with crocodiles coming along the riverbanks and maybe some piranhas and snakes and all that kind of stuff. And we saw almost none of that.
Yeah.
You know, because but like we came into the Amazon, it's 1,000 miles upstream from Belém. At that point, the Amazon is already basically an inland ocean.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's so massive that it's nothing resembling a river at all. You look across, I'm in winter in Manaus, I'm looking out and I can see a little bit of land. And the guy says, that's an island. And I'm like, man, like, you know, we came in from the Rio Negro, which in places was 30 miles across. That was a tributary dropping into the Amazon.
Right.
That, now the Rio Negro, that was something else. That we did about 850 miles on the Rio Negro to drop down into the Amazon from the Orinoco. So the Orinoco and the Rio Negro, though, those rivers were incredible.
That now makes more sense to me. Okay, see, but I just, the whole thing was, I hope you got to see the jungle.
Oh, well, we sure did. But in Venezuela, Colombia, and different things, up in the headwaters of the Orinoco, absolutely. But the Amazon, like, you know, the number one animal that we saw on the Amazon from Manaus all the way to Belém, 1,000 miles, was a cow. That we saw more cows than anything else. There, you know, there are monkeys and stuff there in the jungle, but in most part, they're so well hidden, you hear stuff, but you don't see it. But on the Orinoco and the Negro, we saw a lot of wildlife, a lot of crocodiles coming up, and, you know, it was and a completely wild native people. I mean, like as remote as people could be, you know. Like,
what was their response to you?
Terror. Yeah, like the ones that we met, like in the upper Orinoco, when they saw us, they just took off like they'd seen a bear. You know, we didn't have guns or anything. They were just the sight of us, you know. Well, they didn't. People, you know, and then sometimes we would come into like maybe one or two little huts on the side of the river where people couldn't really go anywhere. And sometimes they were afraid of us. Sometimes they welcomed us in. Like sometimes people weren't afraid. Sometimes, like, we had one family, they kept, their dog was barking at us, and they got mad at their dog because they thought the dog was going to scare us away. And this guy was pelting his dog with rocks. So we thought, well, geez, we don't want to stop here. This guy's kind of mean, you know? And he started hitting the dog with more rocks. And we said, well, if we don't stop here, maybe he'll kill this dog. So we end up stopping there. And we thought, this guy's going to be an ogre. He's the friendliest, kindest guy you ever meet. But and then his kids, you know, same thing. Like, just like, they were like church mice, little quiet little kids, you know. And this little girl, she was just so tiny and so sweet. And, you know, after we were there all day, you start to get to know these kids. And then we noticed they have this lapa, which is like a giant guinea pig. And I said, how come it's missing this ear? And she said, I cut it off for decoration.
That's an interesting little twist on the story.
It's just little things like that, you know, it's just like you try to wrap your head around that. Like, you know, it's one of the things that made me realize that maybe kids just don't naturally have a sense of kindness towards an animal, that maybe it's more taught than, you know, because I've seen so many situations where kids can be mean to animals. But in most cases I see it's because their parents don't have a sense of empathy for another living thing.
And I
see that.
Empathy is one of the greatest things we can pass along. And now we're just going to take a very, very brief break, friends, so don't go anywhere because this is The Conversation. And wouldn't you know, it's almost 29 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more with Dana Starkel on The Conversation. Stick around, friends. We'll be right back on WVIK.
Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins Counseling in Bettendorf, offering empowerment workshops for small groups and corporations, as well as weekend appointments. Learn about discovering power animals to help create harmony with nature and each other at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com. And support for WVIK comes from Aunt Rhody's Landscaping and Design Studio in Eldridge. Designing and installing landscapes to include patios, fire pits, ponds, outdoor lighting, and more. A full scope of services and scheduling consults is available at AuntRhodys.com. And support for WVIK also comes from Golder Care Solutions, offering advice about preserving assets, planning for the nursing home, and navigating Medicaid. Golder Care Solutions has been serving the Quad Cities since 2008. More information is at GolderCare.com.
I'm Zach Morton from Moline, and WVIK is my NPR station.
Welcome back to The Conversation on WVIK, and a chat with this week's returning guest, Dana Starkel. Dana, again, thank you for being with us. Already telling me some great stories that I hadn't heard about before, and it now does make a little better sense for me as my old time, my brief time as a geography major, seeing in my mind the Orinoco and making things work that way, right? So did you wind up coming out the mouth of the Amazon and...
No. So, yeah, it's a great question. Excuse me. So, you know, number one, we had to do all of this 6,000 miles of coastline to get down to the rivers, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't that we wanted to be on the ocean, because the ocean was just, mm-hmm. I mean, it's like facing a monster every day. I mean, there's a lot of times when the ocean is just like a pond, but a lot of times it's like it's waiting to take your life, and it's just, you know, you give it one little opportunity and you're goners, you know. And so when we got down to Trinidad, which is the end of the Caribbean, my dad looked on the maps and he realized that there was a tributary called the Manamo and the Manamito that feed into the Orinoco.
Mm.
And so if we came down to the bottom of Trinidad, where it reaches out towards South America, we could get across the Serpent's Mouth. It's just like 6 or 7 miles. And same thing, like we crossed the Dragon's Mouth from Venezuela to Trinidad. And those two crossings, well, in particular, the Dragon's Mouth was something else, because Columbus, when he went through there one time, he couldn't get his ship through there because the currents were so strong, they swept him back out to sea. Well, luckily we could read about that. So we knew when we got to the Dragon's Mouth that we had to time that just right. And of course, my dad always had me in charge of navigation and stuff, partly because his eyes were not as good as they were when he's younger. And so I was in charge of all that. And I was freaking out because I was so worried about this Dragon's Mouth. And I didn't know how powerful the currents would actually be. I just knew that we needed to cross it when the tide was null.
Right.
And
right.
So I had talked to fishermen every day getting up to that point where we were going to leave off there. And we ended up staying on Isla Patos, which is a little tiny island in between that space, just to make it a little bit smaller.
Mm-hmm.
We
still
had a big jump, though. And so I'd been talking to the fishermen. I had it all sorted out. I knew exactly when the tide would be, and I completely screwed it up. Because so when we left, we caught like not far, like maybe a quarter of a mile from Isla Patos, and I could see we were being sucked right out into the basically the Atlantic.
Yes,
you know, and so we turned around and we pumped it back. We got back to the island and I think the tide dropped like another foot and a half or something. Mm. That's how much we missed it by.
Mm-hmm.
And then we waited and it seemed to stop. And then we went across. But even still, you know, there was just so much such weird undercurrents and stuff coming through there, because so much water sweeps through that small little entrance.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the canoe was doing some of the weirdest things that it hadn't done in 6,000 miles of coastline.
Hmm.
Picked up almost like a hand on a cartoon, lifting you up into the air and then tossing you.
Hmm.
It's like with no control over what we're doing here, you know.
Hmm.
But anyways, when we got to Trinidad and they had some big military boat was looking for us, and we thought they were after us, and we saw them coming. We ducked into this point and we hid behind some houses. They're like, well, we don't know. We came to greet them and they disappeared. Meanwhile, Richie Gage, this newspaper reporter from Winnipeg, he was up in some lighthouse and he was sick. He got a fever or something.
Mm.
He was watching for binoculars for us coming across this, but you know, trying to see a little canoe coming across the Dragon's Mouth.
Sure.
Anyways, we did make touch base with them the next day. But so anyways, we got, you know, so from there, you know, we spent a month and a half in Port of Spain, because the Orinoco was flooding and the level of the river was up over 60 feet.
Mm.
Think about how 60 feet of rise.
Mm-hmm.
And so then when the river subsided towards the dry season, we left from Port of Spain, followed down to San Fernando, and then out across the Dragon's Mouth. And we got into the Manamo, and we went through all those tributaries, and then eventually we got into the Orinoco.
Oh, okay.
And the Orinoco, compared to the Amazon, is like almost it's like a small river compared to the Amazon, but still massive river. Like, I mean, we could barely see across it, and then it's just huge.
Hmm. Well, we've talked so much about the adventures, but one of the things I was curious about was the moments between the terror, right? These were, must have been special times for you and your father, and your brother was along too, right?
Well, my brother Jeff, he went as far as La Pesca, which is a little town in Mexico.
So then the rest, it was just you and your dad.
Pretty much the last 9,000 miles was my dad and I on our own. We had Gabby, who joined us for 400 miles from La Pesca back to Veracruz. He was supposed to do the last 9,000 miles with us. But when we got to Veracruz, he said, "You guys are crazy and local Canadians," and that's and for Gabby. That was the only person that joined us on the whole trip.
But I'm curious about what it meant for you as a son and a father. I mean, that must have been some amazing times because, you know, so much of our interactions seem very trivial, and yet there's a deeper, almost like that current you were talking about that goes underneath it.
Yeah. Well, you know, the way I would describe it is that for a lot of the coastal part of our trip, my dad and I were like two soldiers off to war, and we depended on each other for our lives pretty much every day. And when we got into shore, that's how we felt. We felt we'd just survive coming back from the front line, like, you know, where the ocean didn't get us today, mm-hmm. but maybe, it'll, you know, we got to get down here and hopefully it doesn't get us tomorrow kind of thing. It wasn't always like that, but there was a lot of, it was the hundreds and, you know, and thousands of miles that were like that, you know, especially on the mountainous coastlines where you really can't land anywhere and you're really looking down a map and trying to hope that maybe there's a little bit of a bay where you can get in somewhere. And I mean, jeepers. I mean, right close to Trinidad, we came into a bay. And there was a speedboat, you know, with a bunch of speedboats that were all, they were anchored in the bay. They were so rough there, they couldn't mm-hmm. land on the shore, mm-hmm. even though it was sand beach, but it was too rough to land because the bay itself wasn't protected enough. And so we were hanging on to these motorboats trying to figure out how we're going to get our canoe in there. And then this other speedboat comes cruising in there and we go, "Oh, this is great. We know those guys. We saw them like, you know, a week ago on the coast." So we wave to these guys and they're like, "Oh, yeah." And then they go and they land. And as soon as they land, this big fight breaks out. Guys start hitting each other over the head with 2x4s. And they're like blood flying and everything. Mm-hmm. We're like, "Great. These are the guys that we know. They're the arch enemies of these guys, you know?" Oh, so then we're like, "How are we going to?" So eventually there was a bit of a break. We saw a place where we could land. We land there. We came in there. We thought maybe these guys were going to all be mad at us or something because we knew these guys. Oh, because then they got back out in that speedboat and they had a speedboat fight. And they were ramming each other. Yeah. And finally, the guys that we knew rammed up on top of the other motorboat and sunk it and almost drowned one of the guys. And then they swam back to shore. Then we came into there.
Oh, my
We thought,
goodness.
Oh, great, you know?
Yeah.
And we come in there. They're like, "You guys hungry?"
Oh,
nothing. It was like Miami Vice show, right? And they're like, "Just a day.
Just a day. Just a day." We now, and of course, you and I, you were sharing with us right now some of those peak moments that were very intense and all that. But hearkening back to an earlier part of the conversation, you also had those moments like with that family and how easy it is to become lost in our preconceptions.
Yeah.
And especially in today's media environment, the intentional perceptions that we're being given. What are some of your insights on how we counter that and make for ourselves authentic experiences and memories?
Yeah. Well, you know, when you're traveling along the coast like we were, every single day, a majority of the people that you're meeting are fishermen, live in sometimes single homes along the coast. There's nobody anywhere. They may navigate 100 miles this way for once in a while, maybe once a couple times a year to get supplies or something, or go down roads. A lot of people are so isolated. 99% of the people we met, they would just treat you like family. And I think that one of if I was to say the simplest way to think of it is this, is that when you look at the planet, every country, a majority of it is rural. It's small towns, it's farmland, right? You know, when you look at a city on a globe, that dot is bigger than the city. Mm-hmm. So it gives you a kind of a you don't, it's an illusion. Like you think that that dot is bigger than it really is. Mm-hmm. It's smaller than that dot. Yeah. The planet is so big, right? So you have all of this space and, you know, majority of the people that live on the planet, and even though there's most people are living in the big cities, the people that are all throughout these, the countryside, it's no different than if you were in countryside Iowa or countryside Venezuela. They're farmers. They have their family. They're looking for how they can get enough food to eat. A lot of the people we met, they didn't have money. They existed on the food that they grew and what they could get out of the ocean. And these little snippets that we see from day to day on the news about what happens, well, those are extreme events that happen that make the news. They're not represented. Like if you were to go to Venezuela and go off into the countryside, I'm sure that it hasn't changed at all from the time we were there. It'd be the same thing. You'd be a little guy walking down the road and he's going to go get some bananas or that's it.
Well, I see the same thing even within more urbanized areas that are still nonetheless small towns. But, you know, I'm a lifelong Rock Islander and I'm still astonished when I encounter people who just their media-fed misperception of my hometown is that it is violent, it is dangerous, it is somehow alien to be a human in that place. And it drives me bonkers. But that's why I'm grateful for institutions that we have, you know, the Botanical Center, the Backwater Gamblers Ski Shows, Genesius Guild, Circa 21, when people can come from places where they honestly think they're not getting out alive, yeah. Or if they don't get out by nightfall, right? Yeah. And it's writ larger the farther removed we are. So like you said, people in smaller rural communities, they have no thought other than having a good life for themselves, their children, and moving on. And that's what every place in America is. And when we otherize people, yeah. and do we do that a lot, it just weakens the whole fabric.
Yeah, it's just, I guess, the way things go sometimes. But like my brother's coming to visit me in June. He lives in Ottawa, Canada. And I have really no idea exactly what he all thinks about what's going on in what my dad would call the excited states of America. But
I've never, that's a good one. The excited, it fits too, doesn't it?
So I have a feeling that by the time he gets on the bike trail and we get down to Credit Island or over to Sunset Park or wherever, mm-hmm. he's going to, within the first day, he's going to have a very, very different idea of, even though he's traveled through the United States, but it's been a long time. And I think he may have forgotten a little bit about how easygoing a majority of the states is.
Well, we're going to continue these stories and many others, but this is that time every week where we step aside for a master storyteller. Right now, friends, it's time for Rock Island Lines with Dr. Roald Tweet.
This is Roald Tweet on Rock Island. Most of us Rock Islanders go about our business efficiently. We dress, drink our coffee, put in our 8 hours, eat, and turn on the television. Every so often, however, the corner of an eye catches the Mississippi River flowing past Rock Island, and a small hidden part of us stirs, reminded that we are part of some larger plan. Most Americans share that same longing to be one with nature, as we say. That itch sends us for walks in the woods. It makes burnt campfire food taste good. But it's not that simple. Here's a dilemma a young friend of mine posed to me recently. He and his father had gone fishing at daybreak one morning to an Iowa trout stream north of Rock Island. He described how peaceful the scene was, sitting with his father on the bank, getting their fishing gear ready, watching the mist sift through the branches of trees overhanging the water. In the quiet, he could hear birds in the woods on the opposite shore and the gurgle of the water as it ran over the rocks. Civilization melted away, he said, and he communed with nature. Then suddenly the line pulled. He set the hook and stood at attention. The thin rod bent, no time for either man or fish at each end of that line to think of birds in the woods or mists above the water. Hunter and hunted in an immemorial struggle. My friend played the fish on the line. Too loose, and he would lose the fish. Too tight, and the line would break. It was all business. Fish and man watching each other for the slightest mistake. Then it was over. The fish lay in the net, and my friend relaxed. Again he was aware of the birds and the fog of his father and the woods. My young friend posed this question. When was I most at one with nature, he asked. At the moment of battle, at full attention, unaware of anything except the line and the fish, or at those moments of repose, father and son framed by a sense of well-being. What would you say?
Rock Island Lines with Roel Tweet is underwritten by Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois.
And we get to hear it each week, friends, because WVIK is still on the air, and that's thanks to you. If you haven't become a member yet, well, why not? WVIK.org is a very handy website, and right up in the upper right-hand corner of that page, you're going to see a button that says Donate. And your contributions can help keep public radio alive and thriving here in River City. My guest is Dana Starkel. I usually like to have guests talk about projects they're working on. So actually, before we go any further, we were talking about you've been helping to edit your father's memoir, correct? And yeah. How's that project going?
It's going really well, thanks. I mean, I've been working on it, off and on for the last 12 years. And it's a massive project. It's about 500 pages. Wow. So it just takes a lot of time to go through it. I've done different sweeps through of it. What's taken up a lot more time is that I have my dad's original autobiography that he had just written out in handwritten out, which took me a long time to sort that out. But then he always wanted me to publish. He said, Dana, one day you should publish these two trips that we did. We did two trips. We did one from the Quad Cities to Key West, Florida, and we did another one from New York City to Key Largo. Mm-hmm. And they're like two opposite sides, but he said they're both so interesting. And if like our Amazon book, one of the things that a lot of people have said, there's almost nothing, very little detail about the Mississippi, because the editor at the time, they were editing down from 1,400 pages down to 300 something, mm-hmm. and they had to cut somewhere. And so they thought, well, it's more interesting going on with all the gun shooting and all the stuff in Central South America. So they didn't really go into a lot of detail. But the thing is, I always felt that was not cool, because the Mississippi part of our trip was as interesting as anywhere else. So this kind of gives me a chance to add those two adventures back in,
Well, and that would be great to see. And when do you think the memoir would probably be the first thing we would see? Any idea when that might be available? Or
I'm trying to get that done by the end of this summer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we're not
going
to hold you to it.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's
because
just my kind of general guideline.
There's a lot of other things you do. You're also a great teacher of guitar, and I love running into people who have had you as a teacher, and they talk about what a great artist you are in teaching. So it's awesome whenever we can even get a few minutes of your time. We were talking about your brother coming here, and I got to confess, I can't just accuse other people. If I go to a big city for the first time, I'm going to have a little bit of anxiety because I don't know, right?
Right.
And I chide myself that it took me so long to ride my bike on the south side of Chicago, because, you grow up and you have this, this image of, well, what does the south side mean, right? But it's where people make their homes. It's where they raise their families. They punch a clock and they change the world. And pretty soon, I think more people will go there, because I think that Obama Center is about to open on the south side. But the same thing, if I'm going to a conference someplace for the first time, I may ask the local fishermen, what are the neighborhoods that I want to check out? And I don't have to ask, what are the neighborhoods I want to avoid? They just tell me what to go check out. So it's pretty cool when we can share that kind of info.
Yeah. I think I look at even all of the trips that we've ever done, it's all of these preconceived ideas of all of the things that could happen or go wrong. And none of that really hardly ever does. It's all the things you don't even expect that are the more dangerous things. Like even in South America, some of our most dangerous situations were with good people, with fishermen that were afraid of us.
Right.
And they didn't intend to be dangerous, but they were shaking like a leaf with a gun pointed at us, because they thought we were bad.
Right.
And you don't expect that,
Sure. Sure. Well, you know, we do have to finish the journey, Dana.
Right.
So when you got to Belém,
right,
in Brazil, what happens next? You've got a beautiful canoe, probably a little weather-worn, but what happens next?
So the original idea, the idea that my dad had told me when I was a kid, he said, Dana, when we get to Brazil, you're going to have the time of your life. We're going to get on, we're going to be finished with the trip. We probably get there a lot earlier before winter, before summer comes back in. So we're going to get on a Caribbean cruise ship, and we're going to spend 6 months on a Caribbean cruise ship. And I was like, wow, that sounds like that'd be a lot of fun. So we get into Belém, and my dad looks at the cost of a 6 months on a Caribbean cruise ship, and that's not happening. So then he says, what we're doing, Dana, I got us hired on board a Dutch freighter. We're going to chip paint for a month. So for a month, we chipped paint on this Dutch freighter called the Saba. You know, we worked our ways across. Now, they were going to leave us in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. And once we got into Port-au-Prince, Haiti, we're like, you can't leave us here. They're going to put us in a pot and cook us up for dinner. Because I remember walking around the streets there, and I remember people looking at me thinking, that guy looks like he would make a good soup, you know? And I'm like, Dad, we can't stay here. So we end up staying on the ship. And then they got a call to pick up a bunch of explosives out of Gulfport, Mississippi. So they went into Gulfport, Mississippi. They loaded up with explosives. And now we're in Gulfport, but we have no driver's license. My dad's driver's license expired.
Oh, no.
You know? So we're a month at sea, and now my dad's like, well, how am I? So he ends up going into a sheriff's office. He says, look, you know, I got to get a rental vehicle. We got to get this. We were going to send our canoe off in a Viking burial. We were going to send it off to sea in flames.
Yes, yes.
But we couldn't do it.
No.
It became our home, right? Another crazy thing, you know, when we were leaving the Amazon, as we were going out through the port, the captain, this Dutch captain, he says, guess who's coming in right now? You can't see him right now. It says it was pitch black. He says, but right out close to us is a ship coming in, Jacques Cousteau.
The Calypso.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I said, what timing, you know? But anyway, so we get back to Gulfport there, and no driver's license. And the sheriff's like, well, I don't know what we're going to do here. He says, you're a Canadian citizen. I was like, okay. He says, well, you know, if you canoed from Canada all the way to Brazil, I'm pretty sure you could drive a car home. He says, so let's go figure this out. So they went down to the DMV and got my dad a 6-year Mississippi driver's license. But my dad looks like a drug runner on there. Well, we both did, all with, we were so, you know, wild looking, you know. But my dad used that driver's license for 6 years up in Canada.
Wow. That's amazing. And that's how you got home. You drove from Gulfport, Mississippi.
Yeah, all the way to Grand Forks. And my brother picked us up in Grand Forks. And he said, I never told you this at the time. He told us this later. He said, but when I first saw you guys, he said, if I didn't know you, there's no way in a million years I would ever get in a car with you two guys. He said, you guys look so savage. And he drove us home. We were almost like two monkeys in the back. And the craziest thing is we drive up our driveway, and my neighbor, Mr. Naroda, he had been mowing his grass the day that we left.
Yeah.
And he was mowing his grass
when he got back.
Yeah, nothing
Isn't that
had changed.
Crazy?
It was in the same spot. Ugh. It was like he hadn't moved, you know. And we're like, it's kind of bizarre. 2 years gone.
That's amazing, Dana. That's a phenomenal denouement. Now, remind me the name of the book of the journey.
So, Paddle to the Amazon.
Paddle to the Amazon.
Which you can get at, like, I know Quad Cities, you can get it at Bettendorf Library, or if you're in other libraries, I'm sure you could just have them transferred over, you know.
Yeah. And then you're thinking about, because you did mention those other two trips that brought you to the Keys in opposite ends.
Right.
I totally second that. You should really write those down. That would be a great journey to share. But we also look forward with great anticipation to your father's memoir.
I'm including them with it.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
So the whole thing will be all together.
That's right. My idea is that, you know, a person will have a chance to kind of, you know, people that are familiar with his different adventures, like his Arctic trip where that he did the Northwest Passage and stuff, this will kind of fill in all of the blanks of why he did all these crazy things. And then two adventures that most people don't know about to bring them kind of back to life.
Well, this does bring to mind, there's just one of these little quirks of historical conjunction that here in River City, we had a time when I still think the Quad Cities punches above its weight, but in the 19th century, we were a pretty big deal thanks to the bridge and riverboat traffic and the Rock Island Arsenal and that fellow named John Deere.
Mm-hmm.
And I was recently reminded that Roald Amundsen came here.
Really?
And gave a lecture at Augustana College in the early part of the 20th century.
Wow.
Isn't that wild?
That is amazing.
Teddy Roosevelt spoke in a room across the street here. We've had some pretty interesting adventures. Now, you know, adventures take different forms as we make more trips around the sun. What are the adventures you're looking forward to, Dana?
Well, right now, one of the trips that I would still like to do, I'd like to go and kind of recreate a part of the trip that we did, our Amazon trip. I'd like to go from Winnipeg all the way to Port Isabel, which would be not a crazy long trip, but about a little over 3,000 miles. But I'd like to do that when I'm around 68, 69 years old, or maybe even 70, just as something to do, you know, just to look forward to.
Well, I mean, why not?
Why not?
What else are you going to do?
You know, the reason I want to do it is not to recreate, not to relive that trip, but to have a, because the thing is, it will be all new. That's what I know from going down the Mississippi a few times. Every time I've gone down, it's a completely new experience. You think, well, you're going to repeat the thing. No, the river's different. The people mm-hmm. are different. The towns are different. Everything's different.
Well, I go from my home in Rock Island over to Davenport probably three times a week on average. And when I can, I tend to take the Rock Island Viaduct to the tip of the island, Government Bridge, over to Iowa, because there is still that little downstream tip of the island. And if you're paying close enough attention, you will find that it changes every day, even in the same spot. And you'll see a little more or a little less. You'll see pelicans right now, but then not too long from now, you'll see mergansers.
Yeah.
You'll see cormorants all the time and all these amazing things. And the river just changes for us.
It really does.
And we don't pay attention to it.
It is amazing how it changes.
Yeah.
Things come and go. And on our trips, like we've gone down the Mississippi, we come into towns where, you know, we stayed at below a restaurant, and now it's a big yacht club or something like that. You know,
right.
It's all changed. You know?
Some of it's sad, but some of it, you know, keeps moving on.
Yeah.
I would like to get back up personally to Wabasha, Minnesota. There used to be the old Anderson House Hotel. I haven't been there in a long time. I want to check it out. Well, Dana, it happened again. We've run out of time, but thank you so much, my friend, for coming in and sharing these amazing stories.
Oh, it's just a great pleasure to be here. And I mean, I love the Quad Cities. I love the bike trails here. I can't get enough of the bike trails here and just wandering around town.
Well, hopefully pretty soon as we work on this I-80 bridge replacement, we're going to have another bike path over that. We'll connect it to the two networks, and then we'll just have to have Dana Starkel back on one more time and talk about new adventures. But for now, I want to say thanks to our guest and ask you, friends, to remember that you can catch The Conversation twice each week on WVIK. Saturday morning, live at 10 o'clock, right before Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And then there's a rebroadcast Monday evenings at 8, right after Fresh Air. You can also find recent episodes at WVIK.org just by looking for us under the podcast tab. From the campus of Augustana College, this is Kai Swanson inviting you to join us next week for The Conversation on WVIK, when our guest will be Kate Bodenbender from the Genesius Guild. I sure hope you'll join us. Right now, news, then Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on your public radio station, WVIK. Unless you're listening Monday night, then it's something entirely different. Thanks for tuning in.
You've been listening to The Conversation on WVIK. If you missed part of it or just want to hear it again, tune in at 8 o'clock on Monday evening, right here on WVIK. Support for WVIK comes from Eye Surgeons Associates, providing eye care to the Quad Cities for over 40 years. Services include eye exams, cataract surgery, LASIK, and retina care, with locations in Bettendorf, DeWitt, Muscatine, Rock Island, and Geneseo. More at esaeyecare.com.
I'm Judy McKinley from Coin Center, and WVIK is my NPR station.
Take the world with you, with news from around the world and right here at home. 24 hours a day, we're WVIK. 90.3 FM and HD Rock Island, and 95.9 FM K240 DZ Dubuque. Thanks for listening.